It's January 31st, 2019, and we're in Albion. I'm Laura Hamburg for Promise of Paradise, stories of back to the land of Mendocino County. Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Bill Heil. That's H-E-I-L, just like just being born in 1940, I grew up with that name, and when I moved to Albion, I found someone named Adolf. They called him Jake, but I was still Bill. I was born in Alabama, in a town of Alberta, which is down on the coast of Alabama. There's a little bit of Alabama right down on the coast. Alberta was a town that was a German settlement. It had been a land company had bought a huge chunk of land in lower Alabama and surveyed the land into 40-acre parcels and laid out roads. It was all very flat, sandy soil down there, and said, we'll have a German settlement in Alberta, and we'll have Swiss settlement over here in Silver Hill. They had several settlements around the county. Alberta was one of the more successful ones. I grew up with German neighbors.
Can you talk a little bit about your family, Bill? A little bit about the flavor and culture of those early times?
I said I was born in 1940, and the culture then was I was first generation, actually second generation, born in the United States. Both of my grandparents were German immigrants. When I was born, it was World War II was coming on. German people were really concerned about their heritage. I learned very little about my German background. My parents spoke German when they didn't want me to know what they were saying, which was quite often. Beyond that, while most everyone else in Alberta was either Lutheran or Catholic, that's German, my grandfather on my mother's side belonged to some evangelical movement that was very concerned about saving the world. He belonged to or helped found a church called the Christian Missionary Alliance. The church was very much a part of my life.
How did that influence you as a young person?
The way it affected me the most was it scared hell out of me. As a child, of course, I embraced it. And Germans are taught to believe that they're the best always and whatever they, you know. So I completely accepted it. But I really thought that the world was going to come to an end and that I really had no choice but to get with the program. Like I said, it scared me. As I got older, I realized that there's something was wrong in what I believed. I was out of high school a couple of years when I decided that I really had to do something about this predicament and not knowing if the world was going to end. Or I'd come to realize that there were different views. The Bible actually was interpreted different ways. That what I decided I wanted to do was go to school. And I went to a school that my church was part of, a Bible school, and spent a couple of years looking at theology and trying to figure out what the Bible said.
Were you on a spiritual quest?
I think you could call it that. I think rather than being on a spiritual quest, it was more of an intellectual quest. And that I thought that all I needed to do was learn enough and I could understand what was going on. I think the more I studied, the more I realized that theology was not the answer. Very fortunately, I had a teacher that was trying to teach at this Bible school that had a much broader perspective on life. He tried to teach some sociology and philosophy, and I realized that I really wanted to change. I wanted to study philosophy because that whatever the quest I was on, I would have a better chance finding it in philosophy. So that's what I changed schools.
How is it that a Bible student from the deep south in Alabama finds his way to Mendocino County? When did you come here and how did that happen?
It was quite a long and winding road. I went to Mississippi College. I changed, which was a Southern Baptist school in Jackson, Mississippi, and got a scholarship to study in Germany for a year. And I studied in Germany at the University of Mainz as an exchange student. And when I came back to the United States, I was that much older, and the Army was after me. And the only way I could stay out of being drafted was to, I graduated from Mississippi College, signed up for graduate school at the University of Alabama in philosophy. That's where things started going downhill. I started, in Europe, I'd heard a little bit. I'd traveled in Spain some, and I realized there were people who were going down to Morocco and getting hash and drugs and bringing it into Europe. And that whole thing existed. I had no idea what marijuana was. And at the University of Alabama, I managed to find some people that were a little bit into drugs. I actually ended up experimenting a little bit with LSD, and it really kind of blew my mind.
In what way? How did that help you?
It opened up the world for me. And I think in some ways that's what my life has been about, is opening it, you know. My motto is, for many years, has been quest into the unknown. And I like to quest into the unknown. And some of the other students that I knew were thinking about moving to California. I'd spent a little time in New York. I'd spent a summer in New York City thinking that from Alabama, I could either go to San Francisco or New York, and I would find the same thing. I went to New York, and I realized that it wasn't where it's at, as they say. And I came back to the University of Alabama. Some friends of mine said, well, we're going to go to California. And we caravaned across the country.
And what year was that, Bill? And what were you looking for?
The year was 1967. I was looking for, back up a step, while I was at the University of Alabama, somebody had gotten a copy of the Oracle.
Remind us what the Oracle is.
The Oracle was an incredible psychedelic hippie newspaper that ran an interview with Timothy Leary and Alan Watts and people. I realized that that was much more in line with what I wanted to look for. So getting a chance to go to San Francisco, it was a group of us, I think two couples, a man with about a six-year-old son, and myself, and we caravaned across country as hippies from the University of Alabama in 1967. It was quite the adventure.
Tell us how you arrived in Mendocino County specifically. How did you find your way here?
After I traveled across country with this crew of people, we ended up in Los Angeles instead of San Francisco because we didn't know any better. And they realized they wanted to go to San Francisco. I realized that I wanted to get off of the crew. And I looked up a friend that I'd known at Mississippi College. After about 6 months, I ended up in Berkeley, where my friends had settled. I was there for probably the better part of a year when someone came along that I had known in New York City, a man I had met in New York City. And it turned out he was in San Francisco. I was in Berkeley. And he said, hey, I met these people who are moving back to the land. They bought a place in Mendocino. And I think that they're looking for someone that has some rural skills, and I think you might fit there. I said, yeah, I want to check it out. And I moved to Table Mountain, New Year's Day, 1969.
Can you describe Table Mountain and really paint a picture of what that place looked like and felt like, where it existed?
I think the thing about Table Mountain Ranch that struck me the most was its isolation. It was an inholding by, at that time it was Masonite Corporation, the timber company. It was 140 acres that was surrounded by second growth redwoods that had not been harvested since their original harvest, which would have been in the early 1900s. I believe. So it was beautiful forest land all around. Table Mountain Ranch had been cut over probably in the 50s before the crash. There was a big lumber timber crash in the 50s that kind of decimated Albion. That's when Albion really lost its population. And in the 60s and 70s, people were moving back in, and Albion was one of the places you could get land. But like I said, what struck me most about it kind of was its isolation. There was a ramshackle old house, a great big old ranch house that had been built probably for a dude ranch or a hunting club or something. In some ways, it looked perfect for a commune because it had lots of rooms around the central court. But on close inspection, it was really one of the most shoddy built buildings I've ever been in. It had stumps for a foundation. It was built right on top of some old redwood stumps. It had no foundation. The roof was put together in such a way that it wasn't tied at the eaves. It didn't have ceiling joists, really, you know. And it was, I don't know, quite old. But it centered as our big house for a number of years. And one of the first things we learned, when I moved there in January, it was winter, and everybody was trying to live in the big house. And it turned out that by the time spring came, everybody realized we've got 140 acres here, and we don't want to all be in one building. So the first number of years that I was there really had to do with trying to put together housing. Like I said, we were isolated. The building inspector seemed like something far away. We decided that if we built our, there was quite a bit of cleared land, but we decided that if we built our buildings in the woods, the building inspectors couldn't find them. And it worked for that, but also after living there for a while, we realized that building in the woods is not where you want to live.
Why?
Because it doesn't work because you just don't get enough sunlight. You know, it's always cold and damp, and we had plenty of firewood, and our buildings were really, it was hippies, you know, hippie building. At best, there were some ideas of how to do things differently. I think the whole movement of the 1970s was we got to do things differently. We got to try something out that's different. And I felt like Table Mountain Ranch, a lot of what we were doing was acting out these ideas that we had about how to use a different kind of architecture, how to socialize different, and all sorts of things. But it was really trying to see if there might not be a better way to do things.
I know that you talked a lot about, to borrow the vernacular, to tune in and turn on and drop out. And what kinds of things did you want to turn on to?
Certainly, one of the things that we wanted to turn on to was to understand the spiritual kind of side of life. There was a couple of things, really. The other one was what was group consciousness? And how does one experience group consciousness? And how does that fit in with what we had been brought up with as family? You know, is there something different? At some point, we kind of came up with the slogan among ourselves that blood is thicker than water, but consciousness is thicker than blood. And I think that was really the experiment we were having. The dropping out was pretty obvious. We just wanted to find a different way to do things, from growing our own food to gleaning food over in Central Valley, particularly around the edges, around winters and places, and educating our own kids, that sort of thing. In terms of spiritual, we looked a lot at what we understood to be Native American culture and tried to follow it. And for many years, we had solstice and equinox ceremonies where we would sit in a tent, in a teepee all night and set it up as a meeting. And if we had some peyote, take some peyote in. and did that as a practice for a number of years. And that was very, it was very important.
Can you sort of describe the flow of a day? Like, what would you do as part of your responsibilities and your chores?
I came to Table Mountain because I had some what we considered rural skills. It turned out that it was really the mechanical skills that I had that made my place in Table Mountain a lot. I was the head of the motor pool, and sometimes we had what we called one-car consciousness, which among 10 or 12 people, we had one car that was running. And how to share that and make, if you went to town, you did all the chores that needed to be done in town for everyone. And that car was on the road a lot. And I started repairing cars and pickups and decided that we ought to have one kind of car. And so we ended up collecting old Chevrolets as they died or when we could find one that we could afford. And I ended up with quite a boneyard. I called it Chevy Heaven for a number of years. So that was kind of my main focus. Besides that, one of the things that Table Mountain really stressed, tried to deal with, was gender inequity. Everyone had to be what we called on the house one day a week. Meant that you took over the kitchen, made sure all the dishes got washed and the meal got served in the evening. And so I participated in that. And after we got a school going, which is one of the things we did, somebody else will probably talk more about the school at Table Mountain. But I ended up being what I call the mechanics teacher. And I did that a couple of days a week during the school year, where I would take all the kids one or two at a time. And there were usually a dozen to two dozen students, as I recall. I had a shop that was right next to the school building. It had a forge in it. It had all my hand tools, and it had acetylene torches. And bring a kid in and say, what do you want to do? And we'd fire up the forge and made a lot of pokers, some which are still around. We made some pretty crude knives. The kids always wanted to be making knives, which is a very hard thing to make. Trying to teach kids how the world was put together, that all everything you see, everything you use, some person figured out how to do this. And if you're smart enough, you can figure out, or if you take the time, really, you can take it apart and put it together again yourself if you want to. And that's been true at least up until this real modern electronic age, which is beyond me, but I'll bet somebody knows how to manipulate it.
And this was the Whale School at Table Mountain. Can you think of an experience, a story that really sort of epitomized the feeling of the school really working, you teaching, an experience with the kids?
When I think about what happened at the Whale School, Some of the things we did were just really a lot of fun. And I participated in it from a very specific point of view. One of the things we did at one point was try to build a water clock. Turns out that one of the teachers that was kind of into history had figured out that there was a time when they made clocks that where you'd let water run out and it would turn something. And we spent a bunch of time trying to make that work. It never worked too well, but it was the kind of projects that we would get into at times. There were kids, some of the kids were very mechanical, and one of them really wanted to have a go-kart, and I had this old lawnmower that we worked on for a while, and it was a riding lawnmower, and got it figured out how to make it go a lot faster than it did as a lawnmower. And as far as I know, that fellow's still into, makes his living with his hands doing complicated work.
And what did you do for money?
You know, it was the 1970s for the most part, and it was a totally different scene in the 1970s. So what we did for money more than anything else was have babies. Interesting way to do it. But in the 1970s, there was this program called AFDC, Aid to Families with Dependent Children, and any woman who was pregnant could go in and apply for it. All she had to do was show that she was pregnant, and there was nobody asking about who the father was. They were forbidden to ask who the father was, and get a check every month. And I think while I was there, we had like a dozen babies or more. One of the things Table Mountain did that I wasn't that involved in was a midwife program. We had to do it. We believed in home births, and one of the first events that happened at Table Mountain was a home birth. A fellow turned out actually to be a man who had been one of the founders of the Oracle, which we talked about earlier, ended up at Table Mountain. And he and a woman had a baby together, and they published a book about it. I can't remember what the name of it was. But anyhow, we got known for midwifery back then. And like I said, in terms of money, we had like five checks or more coming in every month, and we did everything we could to not have to use money. But that covered, I mean, we were very fortunate in that we didn't have land payments to make. We had to come up with the taxes, but it was all timber production zone land, so taxes weren't very expensive, and we didn't have any expensive homes or anything on there. So our money output was quite low, and our money input was enough to get us by and still allowing us to concentrate on what we wanted to do, build gardens and build houses and raise our kids and educate them and that sort of thing.
Was there a time when too many people came flooding into Table Mountain?
The history of Table Mountain in terms of people I found very interesting. I said after a while, is that you can go out and see the world, or you can stay in one place and let the whole world come to you. And it seemed to me that Table Mountain was one of those magnets. Even though it was off the road, we had people from everywhere over the years. One January, I think I counted like we'd had 100 visitors or something. That almost destroyed us in some ways. It came a time early on, I don't know if it was a year or 2 years after I was there, and Table Mountain was started in the summer of 68, and I came in 69, the beginning of 69. So I was 6 months later than some of the other people. It seemed to me at some point we had too many people there, and we didn't know what to do. And three of us got together and just talked about what to do, and decided to propose that everybody who, this was in the springtime actually, everybody who wasn't there the Thanksgiving before had to leave the land. and they did, and we said we were going to have a retreat for a week, or I think we said a week, I can't remember. And after that, we'd invite the people who we thought belonged there to come back. That event changed the direction of Table Mountain. After that, we really felt like we had some cohesiveness. Turned out, one of the things I learned is that you don't need a majority to make change, particularly when you don't have a bunch of people that know what they want to do. If you can get three or four people together that have an idea of what to do, and there are no other four people to challenge them, they win. You know, it's been something that, in terms of my politic, I've always felt comfortable working with. You don't have to be in a majority to make change. You just have to get more people than the other side with a clear plan and the ability to move it in that way.
How do you reconcile that impulse with the idea of communal living and, you know, a sharing and equitable decision-making process?
It's a difficult one to figure out how to live together. I think we were really fortunate at Table Mountain in a number of ways. One of the biggest ways was that we didn't buy the land. It was given to us. Two people bought it that were pretty clear what they wanted to happen was an experiment in communal living.
Who bought it? Who gave it to the commune? Tell us that story.
I'm probably not the best person to talk about. This is as I know it. It started actually in what they call a hippie area in San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury. There was a young man, probably about my age then, who I think his parents actually, his father had committed suicide or something, but he ended up with some money and a kind of loose ends and trying to figure out what to do. And people were talking about communes. And he decided to just go into Haight-Ashbury, rent a flat, and ask people to come live with him that he thought might be interesting to live with. And one of those people actually was Zoe Abel. She was the one, she had an infant child at that time, a girl. She wanted to move to the country, and she convinced Duncan that they should buy some land in the country. At that time, there was back east, the whole thing with Millbrook was happening, and there was a fellow who was actually a Navy commander who was stationed at the Pentagon at the time and would go up to Millbrook on weekends.
And when you say Millbrook, Millbrook, New York, where Timothy Leary was doing his work.
Exactly. I know very little about it because I've never been there. But Walter had been going there. Things changed very rapidly in the 70s. And this was really, Walter managed to go to the Pentagon, say, look, I've been going up to Millbrook. I want out of here. And they left him out. You know, it was no trying to punish him or anything, just, okay, you can go. He had bought on his own while he was in the Army, he'd bought a little bit of land in Carmel Valley. He bought a lot in Carmel Valley. He had that money, and somehow, I don't know who put them together, but Duncan and Walter somehow managed to get together. Duncan put up the money. Walter said he would sell his land in Carmel Valley and put that towards the purchase of the land. And I think it was like $50,000, I think $50,000 or something back in 1968.
For how many acres?
140 acres.
So let's circle back for a moment. We were talking about how the fact that you didn't have to purchase the land or make land payments somewhat made it easier to have a communal living situation in terms of setting up rules and boundaries.
Yeah. One of the things that neither Walter nor Duncan were committed to living on the land or being landlords. They both said, you know, Duncan said, I'll try it. And if I don't like it, I'll leave. And you all can continue it. One of the things not owning land means, or none of us having any, it really equalized our place on there. I couldn't say, well, I put in $50,000 and you only put in 10, so I should have more say about what goes on. None of us put anything in. So we didn't have that kind of thing. So it was a great equalizer. I think that was one of the things that was most important. It also took the pressure off. I mean, most places, people were trying to buy land. And if you're trying to buy land, you have to be working or doing something to have an income. It turned out that what a lot of people ended up doing in California, of course, was growing marijuana. But we never did that at Table Mountain. By the time that really became a popular thing to do, we were into having a school. And that meant that we wanted to keep our hands really clean.
Can you describe or talk about a time, a story that epitomized sort of the best of that time that you can recall where you were really feeling like this is really working?
You know, it was probably pretty early on. Probably one of the things that the thing I described earlier about having that a retreat and then have it turned out that the weekend we said that the retreat was over was Passover, and we really celebrated. I don't know how it happened exactly, except there were quite a few Jewish people ended up at Table Mountain, and we looking as we kind of were for guidance in that whole realm of spirituality. Judaism was kind of one of the models, and celebration of Passover, which seems to be such a universal idea. But that first Passover that we celebrated was a moment. I know there were many moments, actually, when it dawned on me that I've been a seeker, you know, and trying to find my way. I would get this overwhelming, oh, yeah, everything that I went through, my childhood, which seemed to be a real struggle at times. I don't think people, when I was a child, nobody really knew who I was or cared exactly, you know, that I wasn't exactly like everybody else or whatever. But there came a time at Table Mountain when I said, you know, it was all worth it. I'm here. I forgive my parents. I forgive everybody.
When did you feel that feeling? That was during your after the retreat in the Passover time?
Yeah, I felt that way at different times, really. But as I got my life sorted out, I loved doing mechanical work. I had a place I could be in charge. I didn't have to. I've never had a not never, but hardly ever had a 9-to-5 job in my life. And, just being able to follow my conscience there, I realized that the war was still going on and that I didn't want to pay taxes. And the only way I could really, in good conscience, not pay taxes was not make money. And it seemed like an okay thing to do. And at times like that, solstice and equinox meetings were really wonderful. You know, sitting around in a circle in a teepee and singing all night.
Listening. What did you sing? What was an example of what you might sing?
Oh, some of the songs that we sang were like Indian songs. A lot of them were songs that people made up. And you know, where I come from, nobody knows. Where I'm going, everything goes. The wind blows, the tree grows, the river flows. You know, that kind of stuff. And Albion has a history of those meetings continued and became more a part of Albion history, I think, than just Table Mountain history. I think some people might still be doing them.
Were there any particular downsides for you?
The biggest downside, for sure, was realizing that this was not going to work. It was like the same kind of downside as realizing, you know, we're going to have to get divorced. If we want to be friends, we're going to have to get divorced. And that was really, that was very hard for me to accept.
When you say it wasn't going to work, what exactly do you mean?
The first thing that I realized wasn't going to work was when we realized that we no longer could say to somebody, sure, you can move in and join us. Because we had too much of a history with each other to let that happen. That, to me, was one of the biggest things that in my personal life. I mean, that what happened was I had a partner at Table Mountain, and we had a child, and we'd been together for probably going on to 15 years or so, and we had been, she was a lot younger than me, and we'd been just living our lives, but we had our own houses pretty early on in the relationship, but over time, we were just getting farther apart. And when I met someone else, they couldn't really be part of the group. Didn't particularly want to be. And I wanted to be with them. And that probably, for myself, is what I mean by it. I realized it wasn't going to work. One of the things we did early on was said, well, we'll make all our decisions by consensus. But we hadn't really thought through what consensus meant. And for us, it meant that everybody had to agree. But what it also meant, which we didn't know, but we realized after a while, was that any one person could stop everything from happening. Consensus doesn't work that way. In order to live by consensus, you have to be, first of all, consent to agree to work out every problem. And if you can't work it out, stand aside and say, yes, go ahead to the rest or something. You have to have some way to deal with the fact that people at times disagree. And so we ended up spending an inordinate amount of time in meetings, and the meetings got less and less productive and more wanting to say, well, if I'm going to do anything, I'm going to just have to do it to, you know, break that covenant of agreement.
So looking at that, saying a lot of that didn't work, why is it important that we're studying this? And why do we care about the people that had this experience?
For me, being at Table Mountain was part of my growing up. Even though I was 29 when I moved there, to me, looking at group consciousness, constantly trying to figure out what it meant to be able to get what I want in that kind of a setting, was just extremely valuable. I use the stuff I learned at Table Mountain every day of my life. Now, just how I interact with people and how I go about getting what I want, which to me still seems to be kind of the basic drive with people. Well, I want, you know, how do I figure out what I want and how do I get what I want, you know? And I learned so much about that at Table Mountain. I think all of us learned a lot. Our kids, for the most part, have been successful. Most of the people that lived at Table Mountain still live in the area and went on to be successful in what they were doing.
Do you feel like there are important things that we can learn from that time of the Back to the Land movement?
The important things that we've learned are the things that we've incorporated into our broader life. The fact that Mendocino County passed a law that says no GMO. That is a direct result of the Back to the Land movement. The people electing the first 5th district supervisor was an incredible accomplishment, and it was done by the Back to the Land people. You know what? I just realized yesterday, or probably the day before, there's a fellow now out on Middle Ridge who is doing a firewood business. He's doing it on his grandfather's land, who the people who helped write the local coastal plan, which whenever that was done in the 70s, said that his grandfather had a sawmill, and they zoned his land for that kind of rural industrial. I don't know what they called it, but he's now can do that business there. And his neighbors, you know, it was the right thing to do. He's utilizing what these Back to the Landers did by recognizing what it takes to have a rural economy.
So is there anything that you want to share, Bill, that we didn't talk about?
You know, if there's anything, it's that, how should I say this? What should I say? You know, I think what's really important is like where I started, that if you feel like you've got to figure out something, do it. Follow your heart and see where it leads you. I think that was a lot of what people were doing in the 70s was, you know, let's try. And on the one hand, it was had that conservative value of going back to the land. On the other hand, it was a totally new and forward-looking way of trying to deal with what's going on. And I think we're in a place very much so right now that we could make some of those breakthroughs that I think were made during the 70s.
What can we do about harnessing that spirit of the back-to-the-land times for a second act?
To me, knowing the group of people that I know, not only the people that I lived with at Table Mountain, but the people who moved back to Albion during that time and the people I got to know then and realizing where their hearts are and were. We're making progress every day, it seems to me, in trying to figure out how to do this stuff. That incremental progress is really great, but when it's going to really help us is if something catastrophic comes our way. We can trust our neighbors to help us. And to me, that, I think, is the most important thing that I've learned more than once during this time. Right now, when my truck burned up, I had to trust my neighbors, and they're there. And I think that just learning that you can really trust people to do the right thing when they have to.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you.